welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our multi-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, and here with me, I am delighted to say, is my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hello, Paul.
Well, hello, Susan. Another great day in KHOI land, and welcome to our listeners today also.
And I'm especially glad to be able to welcome you today. You were drawn for jury duty, and there was a criminal trial in Story County that you would have had to judge had you been picked for jury duty. I guess you are judging it if you're picked for jury duty. Anyhow, you kept reporting on the jury selection all day yesterday, and I was relieved when you called in at 2:30 and said you had not been selected.
Yes, there was going to be a long case, and I would have been glad to serve, but I'm equally glad that it gives me the freedom to live my life, as for some reason I wasn't picked for the jury, and I'm not offended.
No. And this is a program that I am sure will especially interest you, and you would have been very sorry to miss it. We're starting the show by talking with Cornelia Flora, Charles F. Curtis Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Agriculture and Life Sciences at Iowa State University, about a book that goes right to the heart of our interests on Local Talk Wednesday. The title is Rural Communities, Legacy and Change.
Well, now, you also told me, Susan, that later in the program you've lined up a couple of guests to tell us about communities in our own listening area. And which ones are we going to look at today?
We'll be talking with Sarah Thompson, Executive Director of Hamilton County Economic Development and Hamilton Hometowns. The two towns we'll focus on in Hamilton County are Ellsworth and Jewell. And to give us a little insight into the legacy of Jewell, we'll have Jewell's local historian, Dick Steffen.
Well, now, those towns are right in the neck of the woods where I live, so I'm eager to learn something new.
I'm sure that you will learn something new. I was able to interview Sarah and Dick yesterday, and it made me realize how out of date my pictures of Ellsworth and Jewell are. I'm delighted now to introduce our in-studio guest, Neil Flora. I gave her a long title before, whose name on the book cover is Cornelia Butler Flora. And I guess you'll also be speaking for the two co-authors. Hi, Neil.
Hi there. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, could you tell us a little about your co-authors? Because, of course, I'm sure that they also contributed a lot to the book.
Well, the major co-author is Jan Flora, a close relative, my husband. And we began this book back in the late 1980s, we were asked by Annenberg Foundation and our colleagues to come up with a proposal for a television series, an educational television series on rural communities. So we worked with a variety of colleagues across the country with the camera work done by Ohio University and came up with a pilot. And I decided that the pilot should be something that I thought was most difficult for students to understand, which was what we call financial capital or rural economics. So we shot a pilot for them with this, and they liked it. And we did a whole 13-part series that you can still get on the web in terms of each of the 13 parts that are related each to a chapter in the book. So Jan Flora was critical in this as we visited rural communities across the nation to decide which ones were interesting to include. In Iowa, we included Irwin, Iowa, which had been the subject of study along with four other rural counties back in the Depression. And Eric Hoiberg, who was a professor at Iowa State at the time, at that time we were at Kansas State, worked on that chapter with us and was on the screen with Irwin. When we went into our fifth edition, we thought we should think of some sort of secession strategy, and we had one of our students who got his PhD with us here at when we came to Iowa State University, Stephen Gasteyer, who has been using our framework, Community Capitals framework, in his research, and is now a professor at Michigan State University. So we included him, and his particular interest is communities and natural resources.
Now, Neil, your recurrent theme here is the term capital, and you're talking about community capital, natural capital, etc. That's a unique way to look at that. Can you explain how you came up with the idea of structuring it that way?
Yes, we didn't start out that way, but before we worked with a book, I was at Kansas State University working with a farm crisis and felt that, no offense to economists, but economists have co-opted the word economy and made it very, very narrow. And the word capital I used to try to catch people's attention, that there were all sorts of resources. And I say that capital is a resource that can be used to invest long-term to create new resources. If it's invested short-term, it's called speculation. But it becomes capital when it's invested to create new resources. And I said, let's look at more resources than money. So that's why we use that term.
That's very interesting, because you catch all the facets of what the problem is, and henceforth, after you consider that, then what the solutions might be and what kind of structures can be created to revitalize a rural community or sustain it.
Exactly. That's what we're trying to do. And we also, in the course of our work, and this book is really a negotiation between us and our colleagues in rural communities across the U.S., actually, and across the world. As they argued back, we started out with only four capitals. They kept saying, well, social capital is not the same as political capital. They said, you know, financial and built capital are not the same thing. You've got to really separate out cultural capital. That is separate from social capital. So only through great discussion did we come up with the seven capitals. And we don't mind if people add or subtract, but the point of them is, let's take a holistic look at the assets that are in our rural communities. And we were tired of people saying, oh, you know, there's just nothing there in rural areas. We said, oh, there's a huge amount there. Then the other thing people kept saying, well, you know, it's all about leadership. All we need is one person to come in and change everything. And we'd found that in communities, actually, it wasn't just one person. It had to be something that was there within the community.
And well, for instance, Neil, when you talk about natural capital, I'm just picking out one of your capitals here. Just in a short statement, what is natural capital as you define it here?
Natural capital are what some people would call natural resources. Some people would call it the environment. And we look at it as this, we put natural capital first because this is the base on which everything else depends. And it involves soil and water and air, biodiversity, and landscape.
In other words, what's there when you begin?
It's what's there when you begin.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then what we look for is, how do people work with natural capital rather than trying to overcome it? And this has been a real struggle in many rural communities when we reduce natural capital to financial capital. How much money can we get out short term versus how do we work with our natural systems? What do we invest to make long-term new resources?
So this would encompass soil conservation, water usage, planning of drainage, and all of these things that sustain what we have already.
That's right. Yeah. And that people can be very proactive in both appreciating and in enhancing the natural capital that surrounds us in great beauty.
And then you say the next section is cultural capital. And you might elaborate on that. I'm just taking you through your headings of your book here, because I find it fascinating, frankly.
Well, cultural capital basically determines how we see the world. It is a social construct, but it becomes embedded in our interactions with each other. And the cultural capital connects the seen and the unseen. It is our mental causal models of why things happen. Well, and we have to understand that before we can then begin to work in a community. What are those assumptions about the way the world works? And we can't say they're wrong or not or right. We simply say that's what's there, and if we appreciated it. And when we work with indigenous communities around the world, it's really important to understand that relationship. For example, some of the communities with which I work, both in this country and particularly in the Andes in Latin America, have what they call, or I call, rituals of respect, which are ways that they show their relationships and affirm their relationships with each other and the land. And I see some of this in European American communities and Afro-American communities in this nation as well. We have a series of very interesting rituals of respect that make that tripartite bond.
So you would find that in some rural communities in Iowa in the same way as you would in rural communities the world over.
I would find the same concept, and its manifestation would be different in each place. And that's the exciting part.
I have a question. Do Iowa values fit into this category?
Iowa values are very important. And I would say particularly Iowa rural values. The things that I find most admirable is one of them is frugality. Frugality means you do things with the least expenditure of resources possible, particularly monetary resources, but others as well.
That's a portrait of my father, the farmer. He's a model of frugality. In fact, if we didn't turn the lights off when we left a room, he'd always say, "Are you working for the power company?"
but that's sort of, this was sort of our Ben Franklin notion of penny saved is a penny earned approach to things. And another one is the appreciation of family and neighbors. This is really important, that people want to be around their family. They like good neighbors. So you begin to treat your neighbors as family. And so if somebody needs help, you automatically go and help. So this notion of this is sort of part of cultural capital. If somebody needs me, I'm there.
Now, that blends right into the next heading in your book, human capital. And that might be more obvious, I suppose.
Well, human capital is the individual. It is that set of abilities and potential that is in each human being. And where community comes in is it can allow that person to reach their potential and appreciate that, or it can shut off those opportunities.
Well, I think one component of that has to be the school system locally, where the kids, and I'm at Story City, Roland Story, and the unique thing about a small school is that your child can be in athletics, arts, all of these things that hopefully make you exposed to be a lot of different of course involved in activities, but also the hopeful product is a well-rounded person. This has to be a means of developing human capital in small towns.
Absolutely. You know. Public schools are such an important part of human capital. And what is very interesting about the Midwest, as opposed, say, to sort of the history of the Midwest compared to the history of the South, is the South did not have public schools until Reconstruction. And that was a brief time when African Americans had a say in government. When people moved to Iowa, the first thing they established right after their church were schools. And then they figured out how to tax themselves to pay for them. So there was an understanding that a good school system where children have all sorts of opportunities to reach their potential in all sorts of areas is a public good. It is something, this is sort of back to public capital, cultural capital, that this notion of education as a public good, educated children, a good school system is good for everybody in the community. So as opposed to some retirement community say, well, I'm not going to vote for the school, but I don't have any kids in the school. Well, of course we all have kids in the school, that because we all benefit from it. But that's cultural capital.
That's very important and something we can all relate to. And I didn't realize that that was more regional, that the South did not have that going on as nearly as much as the Midwest and other areas of the country. Public school became more of a normal experience.
Well, and I will also give you another example of this, and I will name regions of the country where we do research in communities all over. And looking at both Southern communities and Appalachian communities, we asked about, what about school dropouts? And in the South, they said, well, it was about time that kid got out of school. We're just glad they're not cluttering us up anymore. Another would say, well, nobody in that family ever did well in school. Whereas I was talking to someone this was actually in Minnesota, which is close to Iowa. They said, oh, we have one kid. His parents got divorced, and he was really not doing it. So we're working really hard. We think we can keep him. And these school principals were not somehow outliers. They were reflecting what the community expected of their schools. And when you expect your school to treat everyone to the point they can reach their potential, you have just a wholly different atmosphere about what's going to happen to those children.
Well, yes, my school, Roland Story, the graduation rate is 99%.
Yes, so. And I will bet you there are people in that school worrying about that 1%.
Precisely, because I volunteer in the schools and mentor at the elementary school level, and great care is taken in finding out who needs a mentor. And you can do for them.
And I would argue that's cultural capital and why it's so important for human capital.
Oh, certainly. And I think the other thing, looking through your book, political capital. Now, in Iowa, I interpret that as literally as what sort of clout you have politically in terms of small towns or rural communities.
That's the end product. But we define this. We use the French economists, of all people, to give us our definition. It says we take our norms and values, such as things like every child should be given the opportunity to reach their potential. That's a value. And we turn those into standards. Our standard is every child should attend school until they're 16 or whatever age we set. And then you turn those norms and standards into rules and regulations, often through laws or legislation. And so political capital is our ability to have power, but it's to use, but the notion for community political capital is to use that to help our norms and values be made real and making our communities better. Often we think of political capital as well, and I will give you an example working with Native Alaskan villages. We were working with some folks from community colleges there, talking to people and sort of saying, well, wouldn't it be great if you could get some organization there? They said, oh, no, we don't really need a community organization because we know the senator. And he's the head of the Appropriations Committee. So if we need something, we just take him fishing. And that's a kind of political capital, but it's a very controlled political capital, and it views it just as money. So it's how do we mobilize resources from the outside rather than saying how do we use our resources from the inside to then appropriately get outside resources to invest in making our place better.
So here's what we want to do. How do we get the means to do it from larger organizations or from the political world in that state where you live and that sort of thing?
We used to call these advocacy coalitions. But you have to be clear about what your norms and values are, where it is you want to go. Then you look around for who shares and what organizations share these same norms and values. And then you say, here's how we can work together to help you do your job better by helping us be better. So it becomes a strategic way of using political capital to build a bigger whole rather than simply just get my share of the pie.
Now, I'm going to have to interrupt here because I think this is a wonderful way to approach the book. But I understood when I talked to Neil that we would be looking at communities. And so I have two pre-recorded interviews that I would love to play and have Neil comment on them because, as I mentioned in the introduction, they're from just north of us. Yeah. They're in our listening area. And it seems to me that they are really good case studies and, you know, to demonstrate some of the things that you talked about. One of the things that I don't think Paula's had time to look at are your many stories. This book is got so many illustrations of what this would mean in this community or that community. And we have some right here. So I would like to interrupt going through the capitals, which I think is a wonderful way to approach the book and to just understand how we think about things. This is KHOI Community Radio, and Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson are your hosts for today as we talk with Cornelia Flora, Distinguished Professor of Rural Sociology. I'm not going to give your whole title. Whose book, Rural Communities, Legacy and Change, written with her husband Jan Flora and Stephen P. Gasteyer, who I guess is at University. Michigan State, has just come out in a fifth edition. We have been talking about how the book is primarily concerned with rural America and can be repeatedly updated. We haven't talked about repeatedly updating it, but I think you can already see you started with four communities that had been studied during the Depression. And, you know, as I thought about our communities, the change in where a highway is makes huge change in that community. And if a school closes, it's a devastating change. And so rural communities are not static.
And now you have an interview, I believe, Susan, with Sarah Thompson that you wanted us to hear today that you pre-recorded.
Yes, and Small World in Story County. You've worked with...
Yes, Sarah was once with the Story City Chamber Connection, and now she's in Jewel. And I'm fascinated to hear what you have recorded here.
It was at this spot in this morning's live program that we realized that we would be unable to play the two 11-minute recorded interviews. We hope that we'll be able to bring these to our listeners on future shows. But for today, we were fortunate that my co-host Paul Wearson and our guest Neil Flora were able to provide us with some insights we might not otherwise have had time to discuss.
Well, Susan, what you might do is paraphrase or sum up what Sarah might have shared with you that you remember.
I certainly can do that. Sarah has a very interesting position, and I was really delighted to discover her a couple of weeks ago, before Christmas. We were focusing on Ellsworth because they were opening a new truck stop, Love's Truck Stop. Not just a truck stop, it also has a restaurant, and it's quite a nice little place to stop off on the highway. And in a town of 500, or near a town of 500, obviously this is a pretty big deal. And so I was referred to Sarah Thompson, whose title is Executive Director of Hamilton Economic Development and Hamilton Hometowns. And, of course, that Hamilton Hometowns really perked up my interest. So when we decided to focus on communities for this book, I thought I'd like to go back to Ellsworth, because what struck me when I heard about Love's Truck Stop was, well, truck stops are fine. They certainly bring a tax base into the community, and people stop on the highway and visit the truck stop. But what does that do for the main street? They're going to get their gas and eat a burger and move on. And so I asked her, and I was amazed at what she told me. She said, well, a couple of years ago, Ellsworth applied for a grant and has been working hard on a couple of the buildings on their main street. And this will have a very positive effect, because it's not quite true that people won't stop into the downtown if they stop off at the truck stop. So that was the gist of what she had to say about Ellsworth. And then she said more about Ellsworth, of course, than that.
Are they in the Main Street program, Susan?
Yes, they are.
So the Main Street program is, and this has been something we've done in Story City for years, too. First of all, a lot of the grant money, as I understand it, is available to upgrade and produce beautiful storefronts in a community and refurbish the downtown area. And, of course, not only does that enhance the business itself, but when you see that kind of development and that kind of transformation on Main Street, that has to lift everybody up. You know, as that begins to happen, this is something that's external and you might even say superficial, but it's symbolic at getting the community to think differently about Main Street, which is the title of the program. And as I understand it, there are all kinds of guidelines and resources you can bring in to help local committees and organizations and people like Sarah to start to refurbish downtown and start thinking differently maybe about what's potentially there for your town in this day and time.
I'm very interested in the Main Street program. It deals with built capital, which is coming up, but I think it gives us a really interesting point about how do the capitals work together. And I think it's one thing if a developer comes in and says, okay, I'm going to put a truck stop here. But it's quite another when the community says, we think this would really help our community. We will work with you, developer and investors, through some support we get from the outside as well, to make sure that this truck stop can be related to our community. So people remember this was a truck stop in Ellsworth, not just a spot along I-35. And this feeling that it came from the community rather than imposed upon it is huge. So this brings in political capital, this brings in cultural capital, and this brings in social capital of how is this being inclusive. I think another thing about Main Street and the restoration is the notion of we have a proud past. We did some good things as we built these communities. I moved to Manhattan, Kansas in 1970, and that was sort of the era of putting aluminum fronts on all the beautiful old buildings.
And now we're doing the opposite.
And now we're finally, restoring it. Yeah. And we're saying, you know, these were buildings that were built by local business people. These were family businesses. Let's sort of honor that uniqueness of our past rather than trying to make us look like every single strip mall in America. So I think that this is an exciting part of cultural capital in terms of who we are, a sense of local identity, and then a sense of pride of let's share who we are, and then let's link it to we're not really going to set up a local blacksmith here, but let's say what are the businesses that now fit in this new economy.
Well, there's something else too that I actually forgot to mention with Love's Truck Stop. And when Love's Truck Stop had their grand opening, they made a contribution to the parents' club that was raising money for the high school or for the school district. And I didn't investigate that at the time, but it struck me that this was a way of showing that they were contributing to the community, and the community must have said, what do you want us to raise money for? And they said, we want it for the school.
Yeah, all these
communities. And they don't have a school. Their school is over in Jewell.
But all the communities that have businesses, the example I would bring up is in Story City, you have American Packaging, you have EBY Trailer. They're very visible in making donations for any community activity, particularly for the Booster Club, for the school, and the MAST. It's an organization supporting the arts in school. And they want to be visible. They want to be part of the community. And let's face it, they have the resources to make substantial gifts that really impact these organizations. So that's true, you know.
Well, yes, and it's utilizing large, not locally owned corporations to act as if they are at least locally committed and locally embedded But you have to have people organized enough to know what to ask for. You have to have those organizations in place that they can give to. So it's really, we can say, gee, this shows they're great philanthropists, which is true. But to have good philanthropy, you have to have an organization that local people have started that says, here is what we have gotten together and decided we would use this money for.
Very good point, because, you know, it has to come from the community. And you have to go out and solicit those gifts from those companies. And they want to know, organizations themselves, what your plan is, don't they?
Yes.
Of course.
Well, this is what we try to work with communities. They say, you know, what we really need here is a grant writer. And we say, no, you need to figure out, have a good plan for what it is you want to do. Figure out first what are the local resources you will invest. And only then will you get a local investor. And that's what a grant is. That is an investment. But it's an investment in something that they know what it is. And I think that's can be done locally, but you have to really think about yourself as how can we show that this investment will not necessarily lead to more money, but will lead to happier children, contented adults, safe elders, so that there is that notion of, we used to call it results-based investment.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's another thing that I wanted to mention about Hamilton Hometowns. This actually was the first countywide Main Street program in Iowa and really in the nation. And so it is a real model of what Main Streets can do for small towns. And this is where I would, since I don't think we're going to be able to play Dick Steffens either, is that right, Cynthia?
It's the computer.
Yeah.
I'll have Evan.
Okay, well, we are having more than our share of technical difficulties this month.
Because it's showing that it's playing, but there's no sound.
Yes.
So there's just something.
Something with the board or.
Anyhow.
Computers are good, and they're also very bad when they malfunction.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Space Odyssey 2001. You know, I'm sorry, Dave. I can't do that, Dave. Come on, Hal.
Well,
we're having a very intriguing, stimulating discussion here. And I'm so impressed with this book and what it talks about and how it can help communities understand the dynamics of the world they live in, the background. It's a very organized way of looking at things as they are and perceiving and maybe thinking about what they can be and how you get there. And when I look at my own experience in Central Iowa, being born in the 40s and growing up in the 50s, which was prime time for small town Main Street. Mm-hmm. You know, we can look at very small towns and talk to the old-timers who were having coffee at the local restaurant. Well, time was when we had two gas stations and a grocery store. Well, pretty soon they're nostalgic about something that never will be again unless something happens to transform that community, not into what it once was, but what it can be today in the reference that we find ourselves in now. So, well, I think one of the biggest things to defeat in small towns is exactly that kind of thinking. All those days are gone, you know, and all the storefronts are vacant. And you look at Jewell, Iowa, and in the Main Street program there, and, you know, the dynamics of this are between my town, Roland Story City, and Jewell. Now, in my growing up years, Highway 69 was the main artery to Minneapolis, and Jewell flourished beyond us. Then the interstate was installed in the 60s, and we began to flourish more than they were. You know, it shows you how, you know, being missed by transportation can affect some things, in, at least in the near term, about what happens to a community. And that's been the pattern in America. What towns were served by the railroad flourished, and other towns would wither. And so given those realities, how do you deal with maintaining your community and not being defeated by some of the things that might happen to at least in the near term, defeat you when you have your own resources and human capital and all the capitals you speak of to see what can be done to not only change that, but really enhance that community in that rural area.
Well, I'd like to jump in now with some of the things that Dick Steffen said, because he speaks to that exactly. And one of the things that happened with Jewel is that 20 years ago, now this would have been at the time that this Main Street organization, and incidentally, I'd like to back up with a connection with that organization. It started in the late 80s at the end of the farm crisis. Mm-hmm. And although Sarah wasn't around then and she couldn't tell me exactly, it seemed reasonable that these towns were dying. And this is sort of the stereotype when I started becoming interested in the small towns and said, hey, these towns aren't dying. They're growing. And of course, some of the ones that were not doing so well didn't talk to me. But Ellsworth and Jewel are both examples of adaptation. And in the case of Jewel, 20 years ago, under this program probably, a group of local people, he didn't say businessmen, he didn't say who was on Jade, but it was a number of people, got together and they said, we don't want our town to fade into the shadows. This must have been, if it wasn't when Highway 35 had been built, it was, they could see it coming. And so they said, we want to stay alive. And they formed an organization called JADE, on which I, from the best I can figure out, that acronym would have been Jewel Advancement.
Development. Economic.
Yes.
Would be part of it, maybe.
Anyhow.
Enhancement.
So, enhancement, right. So JADE got started, and they started working on storefronts. And between that time and this, they have renovated 13 storefronts, 12, oh no, at least 11 of which have businesses in them, in Jewel. And also this, I'm not sure when they got hit with school consolidation, but they have done the same thing that I admired so much in the South Story towns, the Ballard towns. They picked a name that doesn't identify any town, South Hamilton Schools, and they're all in Jewel. They don't have them spread in other towns like they do in a South Story. So South Hamilton's in Jewel, but the Boosters group over in Ellsworth, that was, you know, they boosted our school. They didn't say it's the school in Jewel, it's our school. And the other thing is that they, they do all kind of innovative things that I don't have time for now, but several years ago we interviewed their mayor, and he was New York, but he's from the East, and he just loves Jewel. And so you don't have to be old timers. Yeah. People come there, they love there. And so do you want to comment on that?
Yes,
kind of development?
I think we used to call them, sorry, entrepreneurial rural communities.
And these usually have someone from the outside coming in with fresh eyes very often to say, hey, let's do something.
Oh, but what we found in our town that we looked at most, where we got this idea, was in Kansas, a little town called Oberlin, where they were having all these same kind of problems. They had local people investing to bring in a variety of businesses. Some failed, some didn't. But they went ahead. Then what helped was they got a very good county agent, back when we had county agents, from Extension, who was able to sort of pull stuff together. And then they decided we have to act as a county. We are a county, not a town. So we do things all over. They put together this huge Oberlin County Fair that is the best fair ever. They had the local people built the Ferris wheel. I mean, they did a bunch of amazing things with local talent. And so no one really credited any particular person. But it was a place, because it was open to new ideas, where newcomers felt welcome. And that's a huge part of it. So it's not that you're not from here, so you don't understand us. It was, wow, you appreciate us, and you have all these great ideas. So that way of accepting outsiders, not being your cultural capital, your social capital, is willing to be both bridging and bonding, that makes a difference. I have a friend there, Cecilia Cabrera Hernandez. She's from Mexico, and once a month, she puts on these incredible dinners. She calls them Cecilia's Table. And she is from central Mexico and cooks Mexican, genuine Mexican food with as many local Iowa ingredients as possible. And it's fantastic. And people come from all over Hamilton and Story County to sit at her table and have this marvelous food. But that feeling of openness to outsiders, the feeling of, yes, we can try new things, and yes, we're proud of who we are, and people feel really right at home. So I love the story of the mayor and Cecilia, who feel at home in a small town that is really a beautiful town. I hope they finally finish 69 so we can drive 69 all the way there. Really just a beautiful place.
And as Paul pointed out, they had a golf course before Story City. Is that right?
Yeah, they had all these amenities before us, because they had a swimming pool before we had one. It just really was part of the flourishing that comes with being on Highway 69, the main drag to Minnesota.
Well, I would say not always, because I'm looking at Denison, Iowa, where you start out, and these are municipal golf courses. They are not private clubs. It is a community-started golf course. And so everybody in the community can play. They have community swimming pools. These are huge, and it takes a community working together to make that happen. And these were there before IBP came to Denison, Iowa. And I'm sure that these were things that people said, we need this here, we can do it. So you didn't have to wait for a grant, because there weren't any to do golf courses or swimming pools. You just figured out, and I bet there was a whole lot of sweat equity that went into the construction of these.
And that sweat equity reminds me of something that Paul often will remark. Volunteers. We couldn't get along without volunteers. And for example, every local festival, that's true. But the Boone and Scenic Valley Railway, this is a big enterprise, but boy, do they have a lot of volunteers.
Yeah, when we visited over there, I couldn't believe the number of volunteers that they absolutely depended upon to really run a very highly organized and integrated organization. It's like a company, you know.
Yeah, they're engineers, I think, are volunteers.
Yes, everyone's a volunteer.
You know.
So we have all this investment of human capital in something that builds a whole community identity. It contributes to economic development, but that's not the reason people are doing it. The reason people do this is because they believe in this marvelous enterprise, and frankly, I bet they do it because they have fun.
Oh, yeah.
And that's one of the sort of, I think, the secrets of good community organizing is making it fun.
Yep. You have to have some motivation for being there, because you're not being paid, okay? So, obviously, you have to love the project and be identified with it. The other thing that I'm aware of, just by reading the papers and being an Iowan, is the increasing diversity in small towns due to immigration. The poster child might be Postville, Iowa, you know, where great change happened because of a variety of factors.
That's not such a good poster anymore.
I have not been. I need to go back to Postville because we were looking at it right after the raids as well as before the raids. But there are towns like West Liberty where they will tell you, you know, we wouldn't have a Main Street would not be open if we didn't have these new businesses there.
Yeah.
And even in Marshalltown. And the businesses are not competing with existing businesses. They are serving, they start out serving the new immigrants, but then the old immigrants say, the old immigrants, we're all immigrants to Iowa, except a few of us who are Native Americans. They come in and like those businesses too.
I'll give an example of that. I visited Webster City recently, focusing on the immigration. They had a large historic Lao immigration during the time of Robert Ray and the end of the Vietnam War. And they also have a significant Mexican population. And they have a number of businesses on Main Street, including a sporting goods store. And I stopped into the sporting goods store. And I really couldn't talk to the clerk very well because he really didn't speak English. But this sporting goods store was like nothing I've ever seen. It was so much fun. The colors on the tennis shoes just the whole atmosphere of the place. And I thought, oh, what fun. And it was the sporting goods store in Webster City. So it was a real contribution to the town. It was there are lots of I'm not a connoisseur of sporting equipment. No, but it was a very definite contribution. And the woman at the cultural center, the All Cultures Equal Center there in Webster City, said, without the immigrants, this would really go down. And that's a country, a city that's been hit hard by manufacturing leaving. But the immigrants are filling the new businesses.
And we are a state of immigrants.
Right.
Even the Meskwaki were forced out, want their land back,
right,
and are now here again.
That's important to know. That's not a reservation.
It's not a reservation.
No, they bought that land.
Yes. I mean, they were sent out to some obscure place in Washington State. This is an amazing, tear-jerking story that they struggled and saved and bought their land back.
Yeah, it's a great story.
It's a great story, and it is 7:52.
Oh, we've had fun today, haven't we?
We have, yeah, and I apologize to Dick Steffen, but I will announce that he is giving a talk at the James H. Andrew Museum this Saturday at 2 p.m.
Who's giving a talk?
Dick Steffen.
Okay.
He's the local historian from Jewell, but he also is a railroad historian. And a lot of what he talked about in Jewell history was very, very interesting. I'm going to find a way to play that at another time. But I do want to give a plug for his talk because it intrigues me, too. It's Streamliners and Steamliners, and it's to introduce the exhibition that's going to be at the James H. Andrew this summer, opening May 27th, about streamliners in Iowa, streamliners through Iowa, how they developed and so forth.
Tell me again where that talk is going to be.
The James H. Andrew Museum is just next to the Boone and Scenic Valley Railway in Boone.
That's where the talk will be.
That's where the talk will be. And it's a fabulous place if you like trains. It's really...
what time?
It's at 2 p.m.
I want to say one thing about railroads, and he will probably mention this as well. There's a famous sociology book called Death by Dieselization. And what you really wanted to be a railroad town, but you wanted that train to stop. And back when they depended on coal and wood and were steam engines, they stopped often. With dieselization, when you got the diesels, they just whipped right through. And so a lot of towns along major railroads stopped then. So having the railroad or having the superhighway may or may not.
They have to stop.
Yeah.
Yep.
That is a wonderful point, and I'll bet he'll talk about that on Sunday. And so that's
Well, you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, the stories, and events in Central Iowa. And we've been your hosts, Susan Franson and Paul Wearson. Our guest today has been Cornelia Flora, Distinguished Professor of Rural Sociology at Iowa State University. And we talked with other folks in preparation for this program, Sarah Thompson, Executive Director of the Hamilton County Economic Development and Hamilton Hometowns. And we also did our research with Dick Steffen, railroad author, teacher, and historian, for the content of today's program.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Thanks to Ron Carson for taking care of the technical details of these posts, with information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Now, Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song, Backtracking, we often hear on the show, but we didn't have today. But I guarantee you that's a nice tune.
It'll be there at noon.
Yep, it'll be there at noon. Okay. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. And if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website at khoifm.org.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.